since this is the first review by an appellate court regarding this matter. On December 23rd, a Mr. Moore from Toledo, Ohio, was abducted near his apartment while he was getting out of his car and driven around the city of Toledo and was robbed and later was shot 5 times. Once while he was ordered out of his car, and then he ran away and he was consequently shot 4 times after that. And one of the assailants walked up to him, placed a gun to his head, and shot him. And fortunately for Mr. Moore, he survived and lived. He went to the hospital. After that, on January 3rd, there was another abduction. A young woman from Toledo, Ms. L. Akdeed, was taken sometime after visiting an instant quick film processing shop in Toledo, and from the time on her way home, she was stopped by 2 gentlemen, taken, driven around the city of Toledo, and was shot 1 time in the head, and her body was left in a dead end street in inner Toledo near I-75. Miss Akdeed's disappearance was of concern to family and friends. She was reported missing. Flyers were put up by her friends. And on or about January 6th, her car was seen by a friend of hers driving around Toledo. The appearance of her car with her not driving it concerned her friends. It was reported to the Toledo police, and in the very early morning hours of January 7th, the police were lying in wait. The car was moved, and 3 persons were arrested.
What's your point with this story?
Well, I'm recitating the facts because it's, like I said, Your Honor, it's the initial appeal of this, and also I think it gets to the indictments that these 2 individuals get indicted on, I believe, January 17th of 1997 with gun specifications but non-death penalty specifications. After that, there's 2 stories ran by the Toledo Blade that some police officers went to the paper, talked to a Toledo Blade reporter, and 2 stories were ran chastising the prosecutor's office in Lucas County that these people weren't indicted under grand jury specifications. And subsequently, March 7th, another grand jury...
So Mr. Block got them indicted for...
Excuse me?
So Mr. Block got them indicted instead of the prosecutors?
I think the Toledo Blade had some interest here in getting them indicted, Your Honor.
Even if that... Let's accept that that's true, just for sake of argument. And the public pressure that comes to bear on the prosecutors causes them to go back and seek a re-indictment. Now, they allege they got additional facts and info, but let's assume you're correct. Is that error? What is legally wrong with that?
Well, I think it goes...
If they have the facts to support it, what is legally wrong with it?
Okay. The facts that they relied on was that there was a missing red purse, okay? That's one of the facts that one of the officers testified at grand jury that he didn't testify to before and he wasn't aware. So I guess that fact that they're relying on would be a basis for a robbery, but I don't see legally how that fact is that important based upon that her car was taken.
But a grand jury is only looking at probable cause issues. I mean, they're not looking at reasonable doubt, they're not looking at burden of proof, all those sort of things. They just look at a threshold, and you've got the filter of the judge who can dismiss for insufficiency, you've got the jury that filters out the factual basis. Where's the legal error in the fact that you go back and you decide to re-indict? What, can you give me a case that says that's legal error?
I wouldn't, not that it's legal error, but there's some type of discretion here.
And it's discretion, and they don't abuse it. I mean, how is that an abuse of discretion?
I think that it comes up at the point of the voir dire of the jury, when that started, and also possibly a change of venue.
But you have tools to deal with that, to correct that if there's too much publicity, don't you?
Yes, that's correct. And the state argues in their brief that the tools that were that was used was individual questioning of voir dire. But I'm not sure that through the transcript and the record that that it was sufficient. There was an instruction to the jury generally that they are not supposed to take into consideration newspapers, radio, television accounts, and rely on whatever is presented in the courtroom.
Are you addressing now the issue of change of venue?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay.
And it's your belief that the case should not have been heard in Toledo because of this adverse publicity and,
yes,
and the position that the newspaper took?
Yes, Your Honor.
You presented that issue in trial court, and the, that falls within the sound discretion of the judge whether to grant it or deny it.
That is correct. And it was not...
How did they abuse their discretion?
Okay, Your Honor, the issue, I do not believe, was ever addressed at the trial court. In the statute and the Ohio rules, a change of venue may be brought by the defendant's counsel, by the prosecution, or upon the judge's own motion. Judge Franks was the same judge throughout this matter. She never addressed the issue. I grant that it was never brought up by either counsel, but I believe that
Did you raise an issue of ineffective assistance to counsel?
No, I did not, Your Honor. Okay. And I guess my contention being that there was an indictment, non-death penalty specifications. There was these two articles chastising the prosecutor's office. One was an editorial in the Toledo Blade. Police officers.
Counsel, is your point,
yes, Your Honor,
that the judge erred in not changing the venue on that?
Or at least raising the issue.
Is it up to the judge to raise the issue about change of venue?
The statute, the rules do provide it, Your Honor, that it may. It can be to the discretion of the judge.
When neither side raised that, you felt that it was error then because the judge didn't take it on his own and change the venue because of something that he had seen in the papers?
Yes.
I see.
And also that the jurors may have seen, Your Honor. The change of venue, sometimes, especially in your bigger cities, if you ask for a change of venue, you never know what you may get, what county it's going to go to, what judge you may get. Demographics are different in these northwestern Ohio smaller counties, towns. Toledo is substantially larger than any other town around it besides Cleveland. Or the next largest town around there would probably be Lima, Ohio. And council may have feared that moving this may have demographically not been advantageous to the defendant. Another issue I'd like to address concerns the jury instruction that was given by the court in proposition of law number 6 of the appellant's brief regarding the jury's consideration or deliberation, and that jury instruction involved whether the jury should consider the defendant's guilt or innocence. It's the appellant's contention that the mentioning of the word innocence shifted the burden and may have caused the jury to believe that they have to consider not only whether the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that this defendant, Mr. Coley, was guilty, but was he innocent or whether he was innocent.
Well, was he?
Your Honor, I don't believe that that's the issue here.
Well, but if you want the jury to have a chance to consider that.
That's an improper instruction,
yeah.
Correct?
Was the defense anywhere along the line that this is just not the perpetrator? Right? I mean, forget the whether or not he had a clean trial. Are you maintaining at all that the police don't have the right person?
Your Honor, that track was never ran during the trial that I saw from the record.
Right.
There was no.
And was that ineffective assistance of counsel not to do that? Or was the evidence pretty overwhelming on that point as you see it?
The record indicates that there were eyewitnesses, as you know, the defendants were caught in this car.
Right.
Mr. Moore, the first victim, was watching television at the hospital and indicated that he saw these two defendants being arraigned being brought to their bond hearing preliminarily, and he recognized them on TV as abducting him. And he testified to that at the trial. So I can't say that the evidence that there was an eyewitness accounts and that there was a notice of alibi or anything like that filed.
So your strongest argument against the conviction and the imposition of death then is that the newspaper got involved in this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And poisoned the well.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that it wasn't ineffective assistance of counsel.
I do
not to request the change of venue because he's looking at taking this case to Wasion or Mount Pelier or other places where he would be even less optimistic about chances of victory.
Well, chances of some other result than the death penalty, Your Honor.
That's the only victory you're looking for here, right?
Usually, Your Honor, in most of these cases, that is correct. I can't deny that. That usually, in these cases, the factual, what's the facts found at the jury level are so overwhelming.
You don't really feel that you can get there just in a straight mitigation argument.
In this particular case?
Yeah.
The mitigation here was sort of difficult based upon, in the record, the defendant was not overly cooperative. There was prior counsel to the counsel that tried the case. He did not present any type of sworn or unsworn statement on his own behalf. There's record that he did have a difficult childhood with his mother being an alcoholic, drug addict, being found not guilty by reason of insanity for trying to burn down their home, having sex with their own children. That was all.
He was the trigger man in this case, isn't that there?
In the case of.
Yes, but we have evidence and more that he.
Regarding Miss Ella, it's That's what the judge put in her opinion, that she found that he was a trigger man and that she agreed with the jury.
Counsel, I'd like to return to the other issue for a minute. Your contention that there's a change of venue or something, I want to approach it from a different angle, and that's
sure,
the issue on the grand jury testimony. As I understand it, your argument is that there was a non-capital indictment against the defendant.
Two defendants, Your Honor.
And that the jury, grand jury, indicted for non-capital crimes. And then there was a Blade editorial indicating that they should have been indicted for capital specifications. And then there was an additional investigation by the police that turned up more evidence. And then there was a capital indictment. And you then ask, for some reason, to see the grand jury testimony with regard to that entire matter, I take it. Your brief isn't clear to me on that, but I think that's what you're saying. If that's the case, tell me why, if you will, that the defendant was entitled to the grand jury testimony, which we know is secret, within the discretion of the trial judge after having been shown a particularized need or not to decide, and why he had a particularized need in this case, given that set of circumstances, and why, finally, under those set of circumstances, that it would have made any difference in the capital indictment.
Okay, Your Honor, I'll try to take them as you ask the questions. First of all, it's my understanding at the motion hearing requesting the grand jury transcripts, okay, was that at the first grand jury indictment that evidence was presented requesting death penalty specifications, and the grand jury came back without the specifications. Okay,
there was that's what the grand jury testimony would show.
Yes, that's what Lucas County prosecutor put in the record at the motion hearing, that the grand jury was given the opportunity to come back with death penalty specifications, and they did not. And the only further investigation that I saw in review of the record, they introduced three more witnesses regarding, I think, seeing the victim.
At the second presentation.
At the second presentation, three more witnesses asked to that she heard gunshots, saw the car, saw two individuals, and the issue about the red purse. And I believe that was the extent of the further investigation.
So our test then, given that, our test is that did the trial court abuse its discretion? That's the test, abuse of discretion on grand jury testimony. Are you telling me that the trial court not only abused its discretion, but in fact made an error of law?
I believe on the argument of whether or not the grand jury transcript should have been turned over. I think that there was a particularized need shown that the first indictment comes back with non-death penalty specifications. What changed their mind on the second indictment? Basically, it was the same evidence shown.
Well, the Blade editorial did, obviously. We all follow those.
Well, no, Your Honor. I mean, I know you're being facetious here, but I...
Well, am I?
Oh, I like to thank you. I'm sorry. I'm not saying that it's that case for everybody, as it's Toledo Blade editorial, but these people are voting people. They read the newspaper. One juror on voir dire, she did say that this gentleman is guilty. She was swayed by this. But not everybody is so forthcoming. Not everybody comes out and says what they really believe.
Okay, you responded. Thank you.
And Justice Douglas moved into another area that I wanted to address, and that being whether it was not prejudicial that both victims' cases were all tried together at the same time. What this does is this gentleman's on trial for capital murder. It in itself is a very egregious offense, and as the instructions tell the jurors, now you're not supposed to weigh that mitigating. Just the murder itself should not be an aggravating circumstance. There should be something else lined underneath it. But as presented by the state, but also the fact that the court would not separate the offenses, I believe, is prejudicial to the defendant. When it comes to the sentencing phase, the court instructed the jury, you can consider all evidence which was relevant from the trial as it goes to the mitigating, as it goes to the aggravating circumstances. And the aggravating circumstances basically were that they were, that the murder was committed before the act of robbery, during or after, or before, during or after the act of kidnapping. Well, it's hard for the layperson, I believe, and not hold against someone when they're also being tried for taking someone's car, abducting them, and shooting them and leaving them for dead. I understand that Mr. Coley, or the defendant appellant, was found guilty of that also, but the system or the statute lays out a process of what the jurors should consider and what should not be considered.
Okay, counsel, let's assume that they should be tried separately.
Yes, Your Honor.
And he's first tried on the case in which you have the eyewitness survivor. And
yes, Your Honor.
You've got your attention.
You'd probably guess the result would be a conviction.
Okay.
It wouldn't be unreasonable to assume that in this fact pattern. Right?
Okay.
Now you're tried on the second case. First case admissible in the second case?
Your Honor, it would involve...
Same pattern.
Same pattern, Your Honor, but I'm not sure that
the prosecutor would have a strong argument as to admissibility of that, right?
Yes, he would have an argument.
Okay. He would certainly try. Would it be error to admit that?
I think to allow the victim to get on the stand and describe what the circumstances and what happened, I believe that would be error during the sentencing phase. Now, if the defense counsel requested some type of pre-sentence investigation, some type of report, that being included within the report of what the circumstances and what did happen, I don't believe that that would be error.
So the likelihood is the jury's still going to know about it. It just, you wouldn't have it presented in quite as dramatic a fashion.
Correct, Your Honor. I think that the way that this was presented, it affected the jurors emotionally. And as if it would have happened the other way that you just described, and if I can presume that it comes through the prosecutor reading a report or the reading of whoever conducted the pre-sentence investigation, it would be less dramatic and emotional.
Was there an objection to this joinder?
Yes, there was a motion, I believe, filed to not join the to not hear them together, to not try them together.
Was done prior to
prior to trial, Your Honor.
Was an objection again made during trial?
I don't recall in the record that there was another objection made during or before trial. Another point that I'd like to bring before the court's attention would be, again, the particularized need for that grand jury testimony. I just feel that I need to implore to the court that a case is brought before the grand jury to review. The indictment comes back with non death penalty specifications, and the choice was there. And then 45 days later, after these after an editorial and a newspaper article are published, it comes back with the death penalty specification. And it's, I believe that the court erred in the fact that we need to know what happened in that 45 days. We need to know what evidence was disclosed at the first grand jury presentment and what was disclosed or presented at the second grand jury presentment. And an issue that I'd like to raise
the
is...
The same personalities were on both grand juries,
yes.
Right?
No, Your Honor, it was a different grand jury.
Different grand jury.
It was a different grand jury. But also, we talked about the sanctity of the grand jury and its private and what happens shouldn't become public. Well, after these indictments come out that they're with the non-death penalty specifications, the Toledo Police Department is raising their objections to the newspaper. Aren't they violating the sanctity of the grand jury, what was presented there? They don't agree with those indictments? There has to be some sort of mechanism where the court can monitor what happens at grand jury and what happened here. And it was an error not to let to grant the defendant's motion that the transcripts be reviewed. But even if the court orders the transcripts to be reviewed, Judge Frank still would have had the ability to see what she believed was pertinent, not pertinent, if there was some kind of abuse here, or she could say, I reviewed the transcripts and there's nothing here. And it's still private and nothing has been bothered. And everyone is still protected. And when we're talking about a death penalty case, I think that sometimes you have to maybe be overly cautious than just go along the track that's usually ran. And the other propositions, Your Honor, I'd like for the court to review, but I don't believe that I have any real argument as to them at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Benavides.
Thank you.
Mr. Baum.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Benavides. My name is Rick Baum, and I am representing the state of Ohio in this morning's proceeding. We're in the unenviable task of arguing a case right after one of the most high-profile cases in the history of this court, but it's no less important.
Well, it's no less interesting either. The lead point here is that your office, after the publisher of the newspaper decided to editorialize about under indicting a defendant, go back to a fresh grand jury and to do it over and get a death spec to satisfy the publisher of the newspaper.
Your Honor,
that's essentially what he's arguing.
Right.
That's certainly new and novel, I think, in terms of
this newspaper.
Not this newspaper. We're all aware of what they're capable of doing on the editorial page, but in terms of death cases and what how prosecutors handle them.
Certainly, Your Honor. And he does. Appellant doesn't. Essentially contend that this second indictment with death penalty specifications directly and proximately resulted from the newspaper's inflammatory editorial. That's exactly what he contends. Doesn't essentially contend, that's exactly what he contends. But I would respectfully submit that contention is altogether false. The first grand jury met on...
How does anybody know if there's not an in-camera look at the testimony in the two grand juries?
In principle, no one can know for sure, But that is why we have, I won't dwell on the time-honored tradition of the secrecy of the grand jury proceedings, and that secrecy is necessary so that they're not second-guessed or intimidated or anything of that nature. But courts very rarely grant these requests. And at that, it's at the trial court's discretion. I think, Justice Douglas, you pointed that out when Mr. Benavides was speaking. There is simply no abuse of discretion here. Justice Piper, I guess I'm not answering your question in that, you know, we don't know for sure. No one can know for sure.
If there's no in-camera review, then we're all stuck with the representation of the prosecutor that, we discovered new evidence, and that's why we went back to the grand jury. We didn't even read the newspaper.
No one in Lucas County is going to contend that the prosecutors don't read the newspaper, but...
Does it really make a difference of the reason that she represented this to the grand jury?
I don't think so, and I don't even think that issue is necessary to address. In the abstract, it might be if there were no other plausible explanation other than...
And that's what we want to hear from
right,
you.
Right, right, exactly. Why
did you do what you did? I know you can't tell us what went on in the first grand jury, but tell us why you...
Certainly. Well, certainly, Mr. Mandros and I did outline it thoroughly in the state's brief. Basically, and I do want to provide a quick time frame here. The first grand jury met on January 17th, 97. The newspaper editorial yammering for death penalty specifications came out a week later. The new indictment did not come out immediately. Rather, it came out March 10th, you know, about 2.5 months later. So what you would probably want to know is what happened in that intervening 2 months. Well, here's what happened. There was plenty of new evidence. We got three witnesses, two of whom led to a key witness in Summer L. Oakley's murder. That witness was Rosie Frusher. I could explain what she witnessed if you like. It's all in the record. It's all in the transcript. Basically, she heard
these
the
witnesses that you did not have as a person.
That's correct. Maybe I should dwell on these facts a little bit. Ms. Frusher did, when she was leaving a friend's house behind the art museum, at around 8 or 8:30 in the evening, heard gunshots, peered down the alleyway from where she heard the gunshots, saw a car matching, well, put it this way, it had long, narrow taillights, which is the same characteristic of Ms. Elokti's car. She also saw two black gentlemen. One was seated in the driver's seat, and the other was hunched over on the right rear fender, I believe, standing outside. Ms. Frusher did notice that the gentleman outside was stocky and had bushy hair, both of which matched the description of the defendant, co-defendant Mr. Green, who was already, this court has already addressed that case. But Ms. Frusher herself, and this was all in the record, she had some previous brushes with the law, I suppose, and she had some alcohol and drug dependency issues. In fact, when she was leaving her friend's house, she had just returned from a an AA meeting or a drug addict support group meeting, I believe at Mercy Hospital on Jefferson Avenue. For that reason, she was kind of afraid of just calling the police, or as she herself, the term she used was, I didn't want to get involved immediately. And in fact, it was not until her friend had heard that a body was found that her friend urged Ms. Frusher to call the police. Even then, Ms. Frusher was not altogether forthright when discussing the matter with police detectives. She was concerned. She still did not really want to get involved. And it took a while before Detective, and I believe it was Detective Kulikowski, finally did get the full story out of her, but he wasn't able to do that immediately.
When you say altogether forthright, what do you mean? Different stories? Or
no, sir, and I'm sorry. She did not, she wasn't complete with her testimony. There's no record whatsoever, no indication that she was lying or, as you said, told inconsistent stories, and I apologize for that.
The reason I raised the issue in the first place is, and I understand the subsequent procedure, the investigation, and the editorial was just sort of a fun thing to talk about, the intervening cause. What really bothered me was that Detective Kulikowski, who you and I both know is a very talented person and was the lead detective in this case. He told the reporter that he thought the grand jury should have given a capital indictment. He testified to this. I looked at his testimony. He also testified, however, something that really made me bring up the issue, that he discussed it with the prosecutor and the chief assistant prosecutor, Ms. Bates and Mr. Mandros, and said he thinks this should be a capital indictment, he, the detective, did, and they disagreed.
Your Honor, another piece of new evidence, a key one, was Ms. Elokte's wallet.
That, so far, is that so? He did testify to that, didn't he?
That's,
he tried to get a capital indictment on what they had, and she said no.
Which included neither...
But they presented to the grand jury anyway, and the grand jury declined. The first grand jury had the capital specifications, as I read the indictment.
Right. The evidence was not, I mean, we did not have Ms. Frusher, and we did not have the wallet to establish the aggravated robbery element of the aggravated murder counts. That evidence was not there. As for Ms. Bates and Ms. Mandros, as for their comments, the death penalty at all stages, and certainly this prosecutor's office takes very seriously, as any prosecutor's office should. And if the elements are not there, then especially for a case of that magnitude, penalties of that magnitude, then it will not be, then it should not be presented without adequate evidence.
The additional evidence that you're talking about, this was not clear to me from reading either of those briefs. Did Ms. Rusher say she saw the car in the alley with the unique taillights? She did say that.
Yes, sir.
Did she ever specifically identify the defendant as being one of the two people connected with that car?
I don't believe the record indicated that, as I said, and I may not have said it in the brief.
You don't believe the record indicated what? In fact, she did not.
A positive ID. I don't want to be held to this, but I'm not sure whether...
Well, that was my reading.
Right. But she did, however, testify, because it was dark. It was around 8:30 at night or so, but it was also in the wintertime, so it was dark. The only light available was residual light from the freeway, which is right next to the alleyway, and some other residual street lights. And I believe there was some distance between Ms. Frusher and the car. But she did identify the car as a dark-colored car with long, narrow taillights. And I think she stated that the dome light was also on, and she was able to see two black gentlemen, one in the driver's seat and one, again, outside, stockier, bushier hair, matching Mr. Green's physical description. Basically, and the case... The case on which the appellant relies himself states that that these investigations are allowed to continue. I mean, what is the state supposed to simply ignore new evidence that comes along if Rosie Professor contacts the police department?
Did the state oppose the revealing or access to the grand jury testimony?
Yes, sir, and Judge Franks...
What Judge Franks did.
Right.
You opposed it. If there wasn't any problem with this and you had all this additional evidence,
And with a straight dot this problem, why wouldn't you have given it to him?
I personally can't speak as to the thought process of the office at that trial level, but from the appellate standpoint, I think that would establish bad precedent or bad local precedent, and you know, it would send a bad message to future grand jurors saying, hey, well, maybe this is not so secret. Maybe I can be intimidated. Maybe my thought process will be second-guessed.
You have a lot of cases you present to the grand jury. If you don't get an indictment, you go back the next month to the other next grand jury and make sure you get an indictment?
If additional evidence is garnered, yes. But as in this case, we have three witnesses and a wallet that surfaced. Obviously, if you're simply not satisfied because an indictment is not returned, you just don't go to return to the grand jury the next month or whatever, and hope that because of the different composition of the jury, grand jury,
would it be an
indictment.
A fair conclusion from this process that the prosecutor tries to get sort of the minimum amount of evidence for the grand jury, and then if they're not successful, then they go and investigate some more and get some more evidence. Is that a pattern, or am I making an incorrect conclusion?
I believe it's incorrect because in this case, Ms. Frusher, after the initial indictment came forward, she was unavailable at the first time. And as for the wallet, Prosecutor Bates told Detective Kulikoski, said, well, if there's additional evidence, we can resubmit. But I don't think that Ms. Frusher's availability resulted from any additional investigation. She came up on her own after being prodded by her friend to contact the police. So it's not just a matter. And even if it were, in the U.S. Supreme Court case, the name escapes me right now, but that on point specifically states that investigations do continue during the course of prosecutions. New evidence comes up, new theories come up, and there should be no reason not to permit a re-indictment with more serious charges or particular specifications. Basically, this re-indictment resulted not from the newspaper's inflammatory editorials, but rather from the garnering of new key evidence in the case. The trial court recognized that, and its decision is subject to an abuse of discretion standard. There was no abuse of discretion in this case, so in the interest of the tradition of grand jury secrecy, this happens to be the 12th proposition of law. It should be denied. I would like to address the 11th proposition of law, the joinder issue. That's basically a 404B evidentiary rule, 404B analysis. Again, the appellant contends that the circumstances surrounding Mr. Moore's assault and attempted murder should have been tried differently from the circumstances surrounding Ms. Elokti's murder. The trial court, in its discretion, rejected that, and there's basically a two-part test in determining whether these matters should be joined. First, under Criminal Rule 8A, they're to be joined if they're substantially similar. Well, I don't need to dwell on that because this court, in the companion case of Green, in this very issue of 404B, stated that the offenses, the circumstances of the offenses were quote-unquote remarkable. I don't know whether I can invoke the law of the case doctrine, but I will try. Basically, the similarities are substantial. I don't need to outline them. And the second step is that the cases will be severed if there's evidence of any prejudice resulting from the joinder. And there are two tests to determine whether prejudice exists. the first of which is the other acts test. This court has applied this test several times, most notably in the case of State versus Williams, a nearly identical case where there was a aggravated murder and an attempted murder. Circumstances were very similar. Both people were in their cars. And basically, under this test, if the evidence of one case is admissible in the other, then there is no prejudice. And of course, under 404B, the rule of evidence, 404B, evidence of preparation, motive, or plan from one set of facts to another is admissible. The trial court so found, no abuse of discretion there. And the second test is called the joinder test, and basically joinder is permissible, no prejudice results, if the evidence in both cases is simple and direct. In this case, both the circumstances are, the cases are simple and direct, especially compared with the case that was argued just before this one. So joinder was altogether proper. There was no abuse of discretion on the trial court's part. The defendant has the burden to establish his prejudice. He clearly did not, and he is not on appeal. The first issue, at least in his brief, the appellant raises is the change of venue issue. That could be readily disposed of as well. Trial court, again, did not abuse its discretion. Change of venue is necessary only where a fair trial cannot be had. That's under the statute. Many cases, this court has decided, State versus Lundgren is one of them, where a change of venue was granted. Justice Piper, I think it was you, but I don't think there'd be any difference in the outcome of this trial if it were conducted in Montpelier or Wauseana. I don't think there'd be a different result. But in any case, changes of venue are very rarely granted. This is all the more true, whereas here, the jurors are given a careful voir dire in order to weed out biased jurors. And in this case, this voir dire consisted, occupied or whatever, 1,150 pages of trial transcript. During these proceedings, people who admitted that they were biased from media coverage were excluded. Others were permitted to serve only after assuring the court that they would ignore the media coverage. And as if that were enough, still others were excluded for other reasons not even relating to media coverage. One was a crime victim, and she said she couldn't do this in an unbiased manner, so she was released. Another person was a death penalty zealot. He viewed life terms as a waste of time. He was excused. And another prospective juror said that she couldn't be unbiased because she didn't like the defense counsel's hairstyle. So she was, I would agree with that, but she was also excused. As I said, motions for changes of venue are very rarely granted. Even high-profile cases like Abner Louima, Amadou Diallo, World Trade Center bombings, and John Gotti, even in those cases, change of venue motions were denied.
Mr. Baum, if you want to save time for Mr. Cook, you probably need to wrap up.
Okay,
it's up
sure.
To you, but I see him about ready to lunge over the table there.
Okay.
He's
sure.
Bigger than you are.
Yes, he is. Okay. Sure. I will defer to Mr. Cook then, because I was actually on my last point. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Baum. Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Chief Justice Moyer. Once again, my name is Gary Cook, and I did happen to be one of the trial attorneys involved in this case. A lot of the questions you've posed to Mr. Baum, I can answer directly. And if I get into one and you want to ask another question, please do. The first thing, Justice Douglas, you brought up about the statement with the prosecutor and Detective Kulikowski. It is true that the detective was told that at this time the prosecutor's office didn't feel there was enough evidence to support a death penalty specification on the case. However, during that conversation with Detective Kulikowski, it was stressed that if new evidence were presented, then we would reconsider. And
Counselor, you did present, if that's the case, and the prosecutor said, no, we don't have enough evidence for the death penalty, you still presented the death penalty specifications in that first indictment to the grand jury, did you not?
That's correct, and I'm glad you walked right into my next setup in my question, and that just illustrates how weak the case was. Thank you. That illustrates how weak the case was when it was first brought in. Not that it was a weak case for conviction, but it wasn't as strong a case for the death penalty. The first grand jury declined. What evidence was brought forward was very compelling. It was an eyewitness who heard a shooting, walked across the alley, saw a car that matched the taillights of the victim in this, with two men who were later caught driving that car. The evidence that Ms. Rosie Frescher provided was very compelling. Compelling to the state, or the point where the grand jury found it such that they could come back with a death specification. So it wasn't like we're just talking about some minor little piece of evidence. And in addition,
counsel, though, while you had a stronger case in terms of conviction, how did the case change in terms of death spec? What was indicted the first time?
I don't have the first indictment in front of me, but what changed was the actual proof of the robbery. Other than the car being in possession of Joseph Green as he was driving when they were stopped at Canton and Woodruff, we didn't have the actual proof of a robbery. The missing red wallet.
We've seen plenty of death specs stick where the perpetrator is found later with the victim's car in their driveway or where they'd obviously used it.
I agree.
Since there's no known connection between these parties, right, the victim and the perpetrators.
That's correct.
There wouldn't be any presumptions of she loaned it to me or any of those kind of things. So, you have a strong circumstantial case without the eyewitnesses.
We did, but you got to look at the two in conjunction because now we have a wallet missing from the purse which is thrown in the trunk, but we also have corroboration that the two defendants are with the car the date of the disappearance in the alleyway, which we didn't have. We only had Joe Green and Doug Coley riding in the car a couple days later.
So the first indictment was for what, though? What was the ultimate indictment?
I believe it was aggravated murder without the specifications, but I don't want to be quoted on that because I don't have that indictment in front of me. That was in front of Judge Christensen and was later dismissed.
And what's required to get aggravated murder?
Well, proof of a robbery, proof of a kidnapping, prior calculation design.
So, you got to prove the same set of facts either way, right?
But as this court well knows, the scrutiny that is placed by a jury in a death specification case as opposed to a straight aggravated murder case, even in the way a jury is selected, is completely different. The pressure becomes immense. And at that time, as a prosecutor's discretion and a prosecutor's decision, was that weight, without the additional witness and without that evidence, wasn't as strong.
So now we're to something else. I take it from what you just said, the recommendation to the grand jury from the prosecutor was not to do the death spec.
Well, I can't speak to that because I was not inside the grand jury when the original case was presented.
That would make all the difference in the world.
It would, but once again, I'm not privileged to that because I was not inside the grand jury and cannot answer that question. But Justice Stratton did raise the point of prosecutorial discretion early on, and I believe that the facts are clear that this was still presented to a grand jury, and it was a different grand jury. And a grand jury ultimately made the decision, regardless of what the prosecutor told them.
But the justification, whether or not it rises to the level of this case ought to be tossed, but the justification for the second indictment, if a judge could look at do an in-camera review of what went on and sees in the first one, the prosecutor went in and said, death cases, juries hold us to a high standard. We think our evidence is strong. It's a strong circumstantial case. We don't have an eyewitness, so we think you ought not indict for death. If the prosecutor said that to the grand jury, and then in the next one said, gee, you know, we found this additional evidence, and we're back, and I had this in a prior grand jury and didn't ask for the test specs because I didn't think the evidence, you know, if all that's there, then his argument just goes away.
I would agree with you, and I would say that it...
But instead, we're left to wonder.
Yeah, but we aren't. We don't have to guess about that because we know what happened. What happened is that you indicted first for four counts. Aggravated robbery, kidnapping, which is what you're talking to Justice Pfeiffer about, kidnapping and attempted murder of Moore.
Correct.
And the murder of Okaidi, whatever her name was. Okay. Indicted for that murder. Now, the first question is, what makes a murder indictment a capital case? A specification, is that right?
Correct.
All right. Also, in that first indictment, each of the counts was accompanied by one or more specifications. The death penalty specification.
In the first indictment?
Yes.
No, that was the...
Okay, so you never presented the specifications that we're talking about are only with robbery and kidnapping?
Well, in the first indictment, there were no specifications that came out attached. It was a straight murder case. The two defendants were joined in one case in front of Judge Christensen without death specifications attached. And by presenting the new evidence, which, Justice Pfeiffer, you can't go around the compelling weight of the new evidence that was brought forward. And that's kind of what you want to look at it in a different light, and I don't think you can. I think you have to keep the compelling weight of what Rosie Fletcher added to it, as well as the fact that the wall is missing. But once that information came forward, Justice Douglas, that's when we went back to the grand jury and presented, look, we have witnesses who saw this car with two gentlemen in the alley on the date of her disappearance,
I understand
only shortly
the
after.
Subsequent thing, I understand why that has great efficacy. If, in fact, there were no death penalty specifications attached in the first indictment, and you say there were no death penalty specifications attached in the first indictment.
That's correct.
Okay. That answers.
You mean that they didn't come out?
Correct.
If they're in the indictment.
Well, that's right, but we'll never know.
If they were
in the grand jury.
Exactly.
Were they in the indictment?
No.
It's not an uncommon practice for the prosecuting attorney to resubmit cases to the grand jury, is it?
Absolutely not. I've been involved several times.
That happens all the time, where he feels that the evidence is sufficient, and he will then present it to another grand jury, and they will make a finding. He is not obligated if one grand jury even no-bills a case. He's not obligated. He can present that same case to another grand jury at a later time.
Absolutely. And that does occur.
Doing that. Is there?
No, absolutely not. And I've been involved in that process several times myself.
Right.
And
so what we're talking about here is really not as unusual as it's being made to appear.
The only thing unusual about it is throwing in the Toledo blade and trying to say that is the reason for it. And it's really not the reason for it at all. It's a sideshow of something that was going at the same time. But decisions in the prosecutor's office aren't based off the newspaper.
What I want to make sure is that this procedure is not uncommon and that it happens all the time.
Correct.
And also, at the first presentation, how many witnesses testified to the grand jury?
I believe about the same as the second one, except for the three additional.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, so it wasn't about the same.
Well, the same...
You had the police officers and probably Mr.
Correct.
Moore, and then the
Correct.
Second presentation, you had these other witnesses that you discovered.
Correct.
You discovered it.
That's correct, and there was one more bit of evidence that was discovered that hasn't been mentioned, and that was the phone bills that were obtained from the telephone across from the Art Museum by the Sound Asylum, which is where Rosie Fletcher had made her telephone call, which those telephone records verified the time, the length, and whom she made the phone call to. That was also something that was newly discovered evidence that presented the case. I see my time is up, but I would... love to continue if there's any other questions.
We don't love to hear you any longer. Thank you, Mr. Cook.
Thank you.
Mr. Benavides, you've saved about 3.5 minutes of your time.
I'd point to the appellee's brief, page 72. Okay. There's at the motion hearing, there's testimony by the detective, and what happened here was 2 days after the first indictment came out, the detective goes to the newspaper, is unhappy. That's when the story hits about under indicting, this isn't right, this is an egregious offense. And Mr. Detective Kowalski goes in, has a discussion with the prosecutor's office. Okay? And the prosecutor's office tells him that if you go out and get more evidence, then we'll consider bringing this back. So they left it for him to go get more evidence. And that seems kind of should play something on to the trial court as to how did the evidence come up, what happened here. And that's even more of a reason to monitor. No, I'm not suggesting. I'm not suggesting that he did anything wrong, Your Honor.
All right.
Okay.
And
I'm suggesting that the prosecutor says we need more evidence.
It'd be a fair guess that the prosecutor's office really wasn't. Prosecutor's office wasn't real happy with this police officer when they learned that he had run down to the newspaper complaining about their work.
They were upset with him.
Yeah.
Right.
So it would seem like there would have been a certain amount of tension, maybe yet unresolved, maybe it is resolved at this point between...
That's not on the record, Your Honor. I don't know that.
Them, but that doesn't really matter, does it?
What doesn't really matter?
That they might have been mad at each other.
No, correct.
The law enforcement team.
Right. But I think what matters is how did this evidence come up? There's nothing ever tying the defendants to the red wallet, other than the inference that she had it earlier. There's no direct evidence of that. They had her car. They indicted them originally for murder. That right there, and they found them in her car. That right there could have been enough for a specification at the first grand jury.
Counselor, on page 48 of your brief,
yes,
you say, in discussing the first indictment, that is the indictment for robbery, kidnapping, attempted murder, and the murder of the lady, you say this, each of the counts was accompanied by one or more specifications.
Yes, Your Honor.
That would indicate that it has death penalty specifications.
No, Your Honor, firearm specifications.
I was going to say it has to be a firearm specification for the robbery.
Right.
Okay. So
there
was no death penalty specification submitted in the first indictment.
No, Your Honor.
And to answer your question, how can there be any irregularity in the grand jury?
But, Your Honor, there's the underlying where there could have been specifications. I believe that there was the kidnapping, the robbery, which are underlying specifications for the death penalty. I'm just asking that the matter be remanded.
You don't argue proportionality. I assume that's just not available to you here. Compared with his co-defendant, who I see on retrial got life.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because your client's the trigger man. They're in somewhat different situations, right?
Yes, Your Honor. From what was found at the first trial proceeding. We're just asking that the matter be remanded, Your Honor, to look at the grand jury and any differences in what may have occurred between the first and second and the other propositions of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benavides. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.